Hello, hello, and welcome to The Thin Blue Mind. Each week we will be looking at current policing issues and topics within the UK. Our regular panel consists of Steve Bradshaw, who is a TV and theatre actor, Richard Horton, author, and me, Dave Thomas, broadcaster. What we all have in common is over 80 years of combined police service. Now retired, we will be providing opinion and insights from the unique position of having been there and done it. Steve spent the majority of his service on firearms before being promoted to inspector, where he was a force incident manager. Richard was a career detective before going back into uniform as a response sergeant. Myself, I spent the majority of my service on the Rhodes Policing Unit before going into CID and Child Protection. You may not agree with everything we say, but we will make you think. The Thin Blue Line with Bradshaw, Horton and Thomas.
Policing insights and opinions.
Welcome to this episode of The Thin Blue Mind. This week we're going to be talking about social media and the impact that it has on not only the police service, but individual police officers. I know previously we talked that the role of a police officer is quite an individual and lonely profession. What impact do you think social media has on the service as a whole?
I think it has a limited impact on the service, social media generally. It's more people have an ability to do pushback. On a previous podcast, we were talking about when the police put things out on Facebook. My experience, if we stop somebody with a car full of stolen goods, everybody's really happy about us, and I think that. But where we've put out stuff on social media, we've discovered a cannabis grow. Nobody seems to be particularly bothered about that. The comments are, why aren't you dealing with the unruly kids? So you get instant feedback from that, but I'm not sure that changes anything in what we do. The other side of it, I think, increasingly, and I'm part of this myself, you have anonymous and out police commentators from the police service that are outside the normal corporate comms, and that can be quite positive, I guess, can be quite harmful. I think if you want a recent example, if you look quite recently, the Independent Office for Police Complaints put out a Twitter about making complaints if you have a mental health issue and the police haven't treated you properly. And they seem to have an idea that the police got a lot of training on mental health and we should be able to know what we're doing. In terms of social media, that tweet got ratioed, which is you look underneath and you won't find anybody replying to that tweet, and a lot of them were police officers saying, yes, you're right. Most of them were saying, you're wrong, because myself, I was saying my mental health training, apart from reading the good work of Mental Health Cop, was two short inputs on acute behavioural disturbance, which is a medical, not a mental health emergency, and treated as a medical rather than mental health. Which is great. It's good to know that.
It's the old angry man, wasn't it, I think?
Yeah, the sort of strength of 10, but the symptoms and what you would look for to think, well, this needs medical treatment. So there's an amount of pile-on, if you will, and when the College of Policing puts something out, if there's an opportunity to criticise it, I don't think many police social media people miss the opportunity to criticise it. Same with the National Police Chiefs Council, when they put anything out. From the other side, you will get people that are not in favour of some of our use of powers, some of the way that we police in communities, that will take an opportunity to perhaps put out a partial amount of a video from a camera phone and make adverse comments on the way the police have dealt with it, and often out of context. It's a mixed bag for me across social media, but there's not much of it that's friendly. There's not much of it that's saying, yes, what a good job, well done.
I think most people read the comments rather than the story, don't they?
Probably right, Dave.
So a question for you then, Richard. If you could flick a switch, turn off policing social media, would you? Do the negatives outweigh the positive?
I wouldn't. I'd perhaps think of using it better. I mean, part of what I like to do, or we should be doing, that increase public confidence in policing is explain what we're doing. There was one shift I did, which was Team 2 took over the Preston Police Facebook. And throughout a night shift, within the bounds of keeping people's confidentiality and the rest of it, we were putting out what we were doing, what jobs we were attending, hour by hour. Luckily, we had three sergeants in of the three that were meant to be on, so there was one of us that could always take time to update the Facebook feed. And it generally got good comments. People were engaged. There were a lot of people that were looking at it the next day, and the series of Facebook posts that showed what we're doing, that's positive social media for me. That's the police at the front line saying, you know, you may not appreciate what we're doing, but this is what a typical shift looks like for us on Lancashire Police. And we built it up a little bit, you know, Team 2 takeover and what have you. But it's a positive exercise. But as I often say, and you'll hear me say it a lot in podcasts, I think, both in the past and the future, we only did it once. There's a lot of things in policing that may be a good idea that we only do them once. There's a role in social media, and there's probably a role in social media, I think, for us to have that pushback against a national inspecting body saying something that we believe to be poorly informed and without a full understanding of what we're doing. But then the obligation there, I think, is to explain why they're poorly informed. Set out your evidence, if you can, that they're poorly informed, rather than just go, you're a load of rubbish, hate you. And unfortunately, some of the standard of comment that you get from anonymous police social media, I think, is, you're a load of rubbish, I hate you. And it's not particularly thought out. So it's just
aimed at whom?
IOPC, Independent Office of Police Complaints, Emergency Inspectors and Constabulary, Fire and Rescue, National Police Chiefs Council, okay. College of Policing. Those big national bodies that have an effect on policing and make pronouncements through social media about a new policy or a new initiative that they've got.
Well, that suggests a disconnect, doesn't it, between the police and these independent bodies?
It is, and I think a disconnect is okay. It is okay, I think, to say from whatever position you're in the police, I don't think that's a good idea because... But it behoves us to say something more, to say that, rather than I don't think that's a good idea, full stop. But I think a lot of the debate is that's not a good idea, full stop.
Okay.
So it's not a debate.
So who speaks for the response officer on the team that parades on at Preston tonight? Who speaks for that person? The reason I asked you that question, Richard, was because how many layers of filter do we want between the cop on the ground, the sergeant, the DS in the CID or whoever, and the public? Without social media, we'd be talking about corporate communications or even corporate Twitter, Facebook feeds that do report on jobs that have occurred and stuff would have a certain spin or a certain element that's highlighted, wouldn't it?
I think it's interesting where it gives you a look under the lid. There is a genre of police Twitter at the moment, which is people that are undergoing the degree entry or similar and openly saying that either the coursework is of little value and they're just firing their way through it just to get it passed. They're not bothered whether it's a third or 2-2 or a first standard. It's just, does it pass? That'll do. And saying that they're not getting their protected time for studying because of the amount of pressure that's on them to do work within the job. You wonder if they're raising that with the supervision or having raised it, got no joy, they're then bringing it out into a public forum to say, you know, the emperor has no clothes, effectively. I'm on this degree course. The work I'm doing is of little value to me in terms of academics. I'm having to do it outside of, in my home time, in my downtime. Where you get that view under the hood that all is not, as it says in the brochure, as is advertised, and that this is a problem that's occurring across, it would appear, across a number of different constabularies, that's worth knowing. But whether anything gets done about it, that's the other thing. Because to the extent, if you're an anonymous Twitter voice, for example, you're a bit howling in the wilderness, I think.
I have a lot of sympathy for police forces using social media because we are now in a position in society in this century where they have no choice and they're using a system which basically one message goes around the world in an instance. But that very same system that they're using is also being used to attack them. And I think the police are struggling a little bit to try and find their place within it with a smartphone. Everybody in the world is a reporter. There are numerous news channels. This avalanche of information that is out there on social media, and it's a problem for the police to try and find or navigate their way through this.
I think inevitably, under that pressure, corporate stuff becomes relatively anodyne. There's no way around it. It's difficult to say something controversial because from a position of authority because it will get jumped on. You'll occasionally see chief constables near to their retirement will come out and perhaps try to address publicly some of the issues that they see with policing, where policing has been wrongly or unfairly imposed upon to fill in where other areas of provision have failed. But that doesn't tend to be when they're in the middle of their tenure. It tends to be at the end.
So looking outside in then, what would the public want? What you're articulating is a danger of one voice, however positive or negative it might be, being taken as the view of the police service. Corporate comms present the view of the force in which they represent. And again, it's just the public are aware of spin, and I think a lot of the distrust of public bodies from the public come from spin, and I think there's a lot of fatigue from the public for that, and they just want to hear it. Yes, it's a double-edged sword, is social media, but I say listen to it all, hear it all. It's unfiltered. One loud voice thumping a table is one voice. Let's hear the other 999 voices.
Well, I wonder how many people do actually, portion of the population do actually engage in social media. Certainly, you know, my sons and their friends, they have no interest in it, which is really surprising. I think it's probably more people of our age that perhaps engaged in social media. And my worry is, and it's going to bring us on to some other topics, but there seems to be a crossover now into mainstream media from social media, and one is the other. You can't separate them out anymore now. And in particular, talking about bias, or the apparent bias we seem to have towards the police.
I think in the printed media, there are certain papers that clearly have a number of reporters that do nothing else but look at social media for things that can be inflated into a story.
As a FIM, we were the out-of-hours press contact.
Mm.
So we did have a lot of press contact with people. And just like policing, there are some within that profession who probably give the rest of them a bad name. I've got a good friend who works at the BBC, and she says one day they'll be criticised of being too left-wing, another day they'll be criticised of being too right-wing, and they can't win. So much internal politics within the BBC should prevent these accusations, but they still receive them. They keep, you know, the path that they think is right, and they go with what they believe to be true. And having spoke to some dedicated, very, very motivated journalists from the big places, you think, even like local radio news, and they would ring you at 5 o'clock in the morning. There's some people who I used to enjoy speaking to, who I follow now on Twitter, and would be very, very objective and be very professional with the information. And I never had a bad word to be said against them. The area I have an issue with is the clickbait industry that's coming through on social media now. So they can put a headline on social media, someone will click on a link, and there's some advertising there to be gained. There are some within Lancashire who I would fall into that, who would be the most unprofessional, the most abusive, where people are trying to shout at you to say they have a right under free speech. The information that I am, for very good reasons, not telling them, and they will get really, really abusive. And I think that's the element of the media which is putting a bit of a tarnish on the rest of it.
I mean, it's important, isn't it? You're quite right. It is important to remind everybody that the vast, vast majority of journalists are hardworking, decent people, just like cops. And if it wasn't for journalism, then quite a few corruption scandals over the last few years involving Parliament probably wouldn't have come and seen the light of day. So we need them. I think Churchill said, didn't he, democracy dies when journalism does. My experience of local journalists have been nothing but supportive of the police. It's more your red banner papers that these clickbait, you read the headline and actually has no reference whatsoever to the piece that's
you won't
that's
believe
written.
What this cop did next.
But yeah. It's the same way, and there's some parallels here with policing, and we should recognise it. But what I do worry about is the people on social media who take on these fights and are every waking hour of the day have some beef about somebody that they need to defend, and they feel like they are the defenders of policing.
Well,
or the other way is, they are the ones who will have to criticise policing every day, and that cannot be healthy.
Well, Twitter's an echo chamber, first off, because your timeline tends to reflect views that you agree with, and there are many accounts, I'm sure, that just say something to provoke a reaction. And there's nothing like an anonymous copper account to get that reaction.
Why are they anonymous? Because I say, let them be. I'm a bit on the Elon Musk kind of camp for this.
We shouldn't be afraid of free speech, should we?
No, we're not. But how you say that free speech is, you can say it anonymously. I don't have a fake police account. But if I did, and I was saying a lot of stuff, or I was defending policing, or being critical of the IRPC, or my own force, or whatever, why do I feel that I need to do that under an anonymous account?
Mm.
Now, if it's to say, give me a shield because I'm going to say something abusive, not in line with the ethics of a police officer, that's different. That shouldn't happen. If we are entering debate, why are those people anonymous? Instead of just pointing a finger, I'm going, anonymous police accounts, they're all, you know, they're all negative, they're all this, that and the other. Why do we have them? There is a voice, and we need to hear it. It's unfiltered, and that's what we need. That's the only way we're going to get down to the bones about what's actually happening. I want to hear it all, but I want to ask some questions about why those officers feel that they need to have anonymous accounts.
There's no two ways that news has become political, and you can have a story and have two different viewpoints from two different reporters. You think, hang on, is this about the same incident? And I think the police have been bitten a little bit, to be honest with you, because they've tried to play politics in the past with politicians, the experts in the game, and have lost badly.
I think as good an example as you're going to get of how this will affect policing adversely We're looking for a new commissioner for the Metropolitan Police. And some of the people you might expect to be leading candidates for that have said, not interested, don't want the post. And on the one side, you've got the Mayor of London. On the other side, you've got the Home Office. On the other side, you've got the media. It seems to be that office, somebody looking at taking it will say, well, why would I want to be in the coconut shy for the rest of my career? Because if it's not one of those three, or two of them, or all of them, all having a go at me at the same time for different things, how can you ever get your feet under you and actually lead the organisation if you're being hammered from three different sides? And I think with Commissioner Dick, you know, whatever the rights and wrongs of it, there's no doubt that she was hammered from all sides in the last 18 months, 2 years of her incumbency. And it's a salutary lesson. But you also have the media in there who feel free to comment on everything that happens in your patch, whether you're even aware of it. You can imagine the sort of command conference on a morning, what's happened overnight? Oh, bloody hell. We're going to have to spend all day dealing with this now, or all week dealing with this, because the press have got interested in it, social media's got interested in it, there's 15,000 hits on YouTube or whatever.
Doesn't that just say that it's of interest to the public?
Well, that's a good question. Who decides what's of interest to the public? Is the tail wagging the dog, or...?
You've got a very small amount of people who are deciding what is important.
I think media, and when I say media, I mean all of it, I think it's driving the news. I think the media has become the news.
What's the difference between opinion and news?
Well, at the moment, I'm struggling to find the difference, to be honest with you.
Opinion, and with a loud voice, can become news, because this is what everybody is saying. But what I have an issue with, and it goes back to Richard's point here about some very, very good candidates who are probably not going to apply for that role, because there's one opinion there. One opinion, and I've said it before, who asks for people's votes and will tailor themselves to people's votes and set their sail whichever way the wind is blowing, is making decisions. And it's short-term, knee-jerk, when's the next election, 2.5 years, election cycle, kind of opinion-generated stuff from the Mayor of London, which is directing the commissioner in certain directions. And it's that political oversight we have on the Independent Office of Policing, which I have an issue with. And that one person's viewpoint, however elected, is having so much directional control on the Met, which everybody sees to be the whole of UK, England and Wales policing, at least.
I think quackery is alive and well, to be honest with you, because experts listen to less and less, distrusted less and less, and people are listening more to the salesman in the Midwest who's selling snake oil.
I think that's entirely possible. What strikes me is that we're forced to play the game as police service, and the bigger the police service, the more they have to face it. There's this horrible phrase, reputational management, where it would appear if there's some controversy in policing in your local force, then from the force, there is some statement in support of managing the reputation of the organisation. Now, for me, that can go anywhere between falling on your sword and saying, yes, we got it wrong, and this is why, to, you're absolutely wrong, and this is why. But there is that... If it's felt that there's going to be a besmirchment of the escutcheon, if you will, if the organisation's reputation is going to be damaged in the Met, but in other police services as well, there's almost like an allergic response to it, and the reputational management comes out of the cupboard and statements start being made in support of policing to support the reputation of the organisation. That example of Steve saying, sort of rapid changes in policy and drivers. So we'll be saying, yes, this increase in stop and search Operation Blunt will increase public confidence, and we'll get our hands in the right pockets, and we'll stop this scourge of knife crime that's taking place in the City of London. And then a year or 18 months later, yes, we appreciate there's been an impact on public confidence and issues of disparity in our black and minority Asian ethnic communities. And so we're going to reduce the amount of stop and search in line with... And we're flip-flopping, and where's the actual professional view in there from policing that
here's a question.
Think we need to do this?
Are media influencing policy? And the only reason I mention that is that there's quite a few news channels, new news channels now, aren't there? And there's three-hour shows of presenting the news, but from the presenter's viewpoint, and they become monologues. But it seems to be now that news is just more of an opinion rather than stating fact.
citizen journalist is the thing they talk about now. Everybody with a camera phone or that's out and about with social media can instantly post what is almost always an opinion.
Good.
And yeah, that maybe is a good thing, but the citizen journalist is there, so you're going to have more opinion in your news feed.
Well, opinion's all right as long as it doesn't interfere with mine.
Exactly, yeah. So the thing is, it's not the saying, it's the receiving in many ways. And I'm not saying, you know, you receive hurtful stuff and so it's your fault. I'm not saying that. Just because everybody has an opinion, don't have to listen to it all.
It's on about, you're on about opinion. Isn't it interesting that a lot of these, I'll call them celebrities for want of a better word, if they don't like what you say, you get blocked. That's interesting, isn't it? That's like that. I don't like what you're saying, Steve, so I'm going to put some gaffer tape over your mouth.
I think Colin Brazier, the news anchor, put on Twitter that he'd been blocked by Piers Morgan. And Piers Morgan on his show the other night was talking to somebody and asking their opinion, and he said, oh, before you came on the show, I had to unblock you.
Yes.
Again,
it's a noise gate in the audio world.
Yeah, I will defend your right to say what you want, even if I don't agree with it.
Yeah,
but I don't have to hear it. So I can block you. So don't get offended if I block you, because, Dave, I don't agree with you. Just because you've got a right to say it doesn't mean you've got a right to be heard. Because if you're saying something which is completely left field and completely on, you know, the minority, fine, you'll be ignored. So don't get upset and start shouting and start banging the table when you do get ignored.
Well, that's interesting, isn't it? Because on social media, at least, you see it all the time, and call it a pile-on, don't we, on Twitter, where a post is retweeted and everybody gets on the bandwagon, so to speak. And that's when opinion turns into abuse. Some quite vile, nasty abuse.
Yeah.
And it goes back to what you were saying, like freedom of speech. Where do we draw the line on that?
I'll tell you where it bites in policing. It's what I call the curse of the WhatsApp group. Bobbies like to have little communities, and social media's allowed them to have that, where they can communicate with each other in what they think is a confidential environment. And some of the stuff that's happened, particularly recent cases in the Met, has shown that eventually that may not be a confidential environment, and your misogyny and your disreputable conduct in the way you actually think about people, is because what you've expressed in a confidential conversation is suddenly out there for everybody to look at. One of the pieces of advice I would give newly appointed sergeants is don't get involved in the team WhatsApp group. You do not want to know about it. But that is a real tricky area when police officers are talking to each other in what they think is a confidential forum, just amongst mates, amongst friends. But it kind of often isn't, because it just takes somebody's phone to get involved in an investigation and get read, and all of a sudden those messages can be out there for everybody to read and understand and take a plain meaning of, whether it was light-hearted or not. The worst imputation will generally be put on what you say. There are cases of it happening where it's been exposed, you know, a culture at an entire station, potentially, or an entire relief, was exchanging all sorts of rotten stuff with each other.
What do you not think, then? You saying, as a sergeant, don't be involved in it. If there is something going on, don't they need to be part of it? I'm not saying perpetrating it. They need to hear it so they can deal with it. That's
well, we're getting into the realms of spot checks on Bobby's phones now, aren't we, which has been a big issue of late.
It's been put forward.
Absolute nonsense.
We're in agreement with that, Steve. We are. You want to have a grip on your team so you have an idea what's going on. At what level of granularity you need to be monitoring your team? Do you need to be part of a WhatsApp group so you can look at all the messages and read all the messages? Would they even want you in the group?
Well, that's a different thing, isn't it? Because what you're doing there is shying away from listening to a comment which isn't right, which you need to deal with. It's just the same way as you can be, in our time, you can be in the restroom with your team, conversations are going somewhere, and you think, actually, I need to walk out of this room now. It's a similar sort of thing, I suppose, isn't it?
Walk out the room or address it.
And then you're guilty of not reporting it because you've witnessed some behaviour that perhaps goes against the grain.
And you should challenge that behaviour, and it should be dealt with appropriately. That's police officers between themselves in what they think a confidential use of social media to be in contact. Mm. There could be some bad stuff going on under there, and when it comes out, stuff that you thought was flippant or was actually, it turns out, in the harsh light of day, it's absolutely unacceptable and doesn't sit with the code of ethics, with what you'd expect of a police officer in their conduct.
For the sake of the 99%, drive it out, shine a light on it.
Mm.
And the WhatsApp groups is just a modern version of sat around the restroom.
Yes, it is.
Isn't it? There's a lot of positive in there because you can sort out things, people can discuss jobs, you can get feedback and stuff.
I remember once somebody telling me that a certain police force wanted to outlaw WhatsApp groups and make them banned, but they couldn't because the chief officer police team had
their own WhatsApp group.
Yeah. I'd like to think vast majority of people join the job to do good. We fear the 1%. But I draw a line of this fishing trip of you're encroaching onto my right under ECHR to a family and private life. No, the government's not doing that. The state, if you will, is not doing that. But if there's something that's said on WhatsApp group, expose it.
Well, let's go back to the media, and you talk about that 1%. Why do we think, it seems to be the impression that the media are so intent on reporting the 1%, but not the good work of the 99%?
That betrayal of trust is an eternal story. It's a strong story. Those that we trust to guard us and to look over us, you know, have betrayed that trust, or one of them has betrayed that trust, or a group of them has done what they shouldn't have done. Big story. It chimes with people, the betrayal of trust.
Or is it simply that bad news sells, where our human makeup is that we are drawn to bad news rather than good?
I'm with Richard. It's we are in a position of trust, and we are in a position of power. Anything that would affect that viewpoint with the public is free game. And yes, we do get treated differently.
And being fair to the media, it's not just the police. There's all sorts of professions. And currently, there's, I hate it, it's like Partygate, Beergate. It's become an obsession now.
The legal blogger David Alan Green wrote a piece this week which was interesting, in that make a complaint to the police about what your political opponent is doing has now entered the political playbook. And so you had people from one party made a complaint about Durham and Beer and Curry, people from another party encouraging the Metropolitan Police to investigate parties at Whitehall and Downing Street. And it's part of a political playbook now. And that pressure is somewhat politically driven.
It's part of the political playbook because the politicians have seen that they can actually affect policing at the highest level.
My worry is, Richard, you've mentioned it with the candidates for the Met Commissioner's job, is that people, perfectly good candidates that want to become police officers, won't. Why should I subject myself to this constant drip, drip, drip of negativity? And it gets to the point of be careful what you wish for, and ultimately the losers are going to be the public.
You get this situation, I guess, where there's a number of candidates who have perhaps demonstrated that they are more than capable of running operationally successfully something the size of the Met, but they're not doing it because I don't think they feel they can do it successfully in the current political and media climate.
The Thin Blue Line with Bradshaw, Horton and Thomas.
Policing insights and opinions.
Well, you've heard our take on it. We thought it would be helpful to get the views of a renowned professional within the journalistic industry.
Danny Short has for several decades been a BBC journalist specialising in home affairs and has presented on many of the BBC's flagship programmes, both on TV and radio. He has won several awards for his work and he has taught home affairs to the journalism students at the City University in London. Danny blogs on his own website, dannyshort.net, and he's also the head of strategy and insight for criminal justice consultancy Crest Advisory. He's also a regular contributor to Policing TV, and I'm delighted to say he joins me now. Danny, welcome to The Thin Blue Mind. Could I get your view on media impartiality? There is a perception that there is a negative bias against police.
I don't think there's a negative bias against the police per se. I think that what you have to realise and understand is that the media news in general, report things that go wrong. The thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of interactions that the police have with members of the public that go well, where the police are helpful, where the police, you know, whether it's as simple as giving directions or whether it's helping to solve a crime, that is what we expect the police to do. We expect those things to go well. That's not news. When an investigation is completed successfully, that's not news. Where things go wrong, that's when it becomes news. And I think you have to realise that with every walk of life. It's not news that a patient has been given a medicine by a doctor and gets better. It is news when a doctor fails to diagnose a patient's condition and the patient, you know, dies. That becomes a news story. And it's the same in any walk of life and any profession. Things that go wrong, bad things, complaints, tend to generate news coverage. because they're more unusual and they're more disturbing and concerning. So I think there has to be an understanding about that. Having said that, I think there is scope for more good stories about the police, for more accounts of bravery or amazing investigative breakthroughs and so on. But that really is up to individual police officers or communications officers to sort of make the media aware of those. And there are ways of doing it, and sometimes that does happen. So I don't actually think there is a negative perception against the police. I think the other thing that happens is when you get a very big scandal or a series of terrible events, for example, that we've had in the Metropolitan Police, that can certainly look as though there's a negative perception against the police. And I think it can sometimes make the media perhaps look for or seize upon other examples which tend to perhaps sort of show that there's a, you know, that there's a pattern. I think that is something that the media needs to guard against. But, you know, I think in general, the media see the value that the police do, and in many situations are supportive of it. That's not to say that there aren't substantial improvements that need to be made in policing, particularly in regard of the culture that's been demonstrated in recent times, and in investigations, certainly with a very low, at the moment, a very low charge rate, a prosecution rate, which I know is not completely down to the police, but, you know, they have to take some responsibility for that too.
Now, we've all lived through the digital revolution, which has seen the way news is gathered and presented fundamentally change. At times, it seems that these new outlets have become the news. In your view, what or who drives the news cycle in this modern era?
The media landscape has transformed over the past 10 or 15 years. It used to be the case that there were just the national and local newspapers, and then the sort of the main broadcasters, ITV, Sky, BBC, with a few others internationally. That has obviously now changed. You know, anyone can broadcast, anyone can set up a small operation, get their views out there, be it on Twitter or on other social media sites. And I think that's really brought challenges for the police and made it very difficult. Having said that, most people get their news still from the BBC, ITV, Sky, the main newspapers. They are still the main outlets that drive the news agenda, influence the news agenda, can amplify people's concerns, or, you know, as well, you know, if they decide to ignore or play down particular stories, that can have an influence too. So they're still the key outlets, I would say, even though social media, you know, has got a, you know, much more than a sort of a foothold in the media world as well. But, don't forget, you know, a post on Twitter, a post on social media, it might go viral, but that doesn't mean it's really got the same sort of credibility as if it gets picked up by the BBC or the Guardian or the Times or whatever. And so I don't think you should forget the influence of mainstream media.
Finally, with regards to media relations, what aren't the police doing that you feel they should be, and what can they do better?
I think in general, police need to explain what they do better, more clearly and more often. I don't think police officers or enough of them are comfortable with communicating in the media and with the media. And I think that they are well behind the curve in relation to that. So in general, I think they need to improve the way they communicate. You know, it used to be the case that people just accepted the police's word. There was almost a sort of a sense in the police, we know best. We do the investigations, we've got the knowledge, we've got the information you haven't got, leave it to us. That's not good enough anymore. We live in a society where people just won't accept those sorts of explanations. People want to know the reasons for an investigation, the reasons why an investigation hasn't been conducted, the reasons why a particular conclusion has been reached. People want more information. So I think there's a lot more that the police can put in the public domain and communicate without compromising investigations, without, defaming people and so on. And that's what I think they've got to do. And I think that's incumbent upon police officers at all levels, particularly at the senior leadership levels, but at all levels as well. I think they have to get smarter with social media. Some police forces are better in it than others, but they need to understand that to get messages across quickly, you have to do that through social media. It's no good sort of sending a press release the day afterwards. And I think the third thing that they have to do is to be more proactive in terms of, you know, highlighting the good work that they do, the investigative work that's led to fantastic prosecution, for example. And I think they need to get smarter at that. There is hunger, there is a desire to tell those stories in the media, and I think the police need to recognise that more.
Thank you very much to Danny Shaw for his viewpoints. It certainly makes you think, doesn't it? Now, in what will become a regular part of the show and to end the podcast, we'll be looking at policing through an alternative view. This week, it's the turn of Steve Bradshaw, who will be putting on his acting tights, applying some makeup, and talking his hair, and giving us a view of the police through the lens of Shakespeare. The Acting Inspector, with Stephen Bradshaw.
Leadership in policing has, in my service, moved a long way from the table-thumping, finger-pointing, shouty style of JFDI. Just flipping do it. To a more inclusive and person-focused approach. I've worked for some excellent leaders in the police, from whom I've taken parts of their style forward in my own leadership journey. But the actor in me remains fascinated in how leadership is portrayed in Shakespeare's plays. So I want to look back over 400 years and explore what Shakespeare told us about leadership. Looking across the plays, generally speaking, leadership roles in Shakespeare tend to be accompanied on their journey by madness, misery, suicide, and of course, witches. Perhaps that's the first parallel with policing. It can be tricky to extract leadership guidance from Shakespeare. Tricky, but tempting. No one described the human condition with all its greatness and foibles quite like Shakespeare, who believed that leadership was a performance art in itself and that leaders were made and not born. So mindful of the audience of this podcast, these are a couple of my tongue-in-cheek leadership lessons from the pages of Shakespeare's plays. If you can, try and visualise a leader from your own service who may match these traits. Number one, trust your instincts. Leadership has to come from within you. If you try and wear a mask, it will slip. If you try and be a vastly different person in work than at home, you won't be authentic. And look out for gym-obsessed insomniacs who are just waiting to stab you in the back. Roman leader Julius Caesar had a bad feeling about Cassius. However, he didn't act on his instincts, leaving Cassius free to lead a successful plot to assassinate him. Cassius even corrupts Caesar's most faithful ally, Brutus, into wielding the knife. As a stricken Caesar recognises him amongst his assassins, he utters the play's most famous line, "Et tu, Brute?" It's become a poignant catchphrase for a betrayal. Now, I'm not saying that those that you lead are plotting to literally knife you in the back, but it's important for you to be guided by your instincts. After all, it is you being you that got you into the leader position in the first place. Number two, watch out for yes men and women. When the elderly King Lear decides to hand his realm over to his three daughters, he unwisely offers to give the biggest chunk to the one who loves him most. Two daughters promptly lavish him with praise. The third, Cordelia, finds the whole spectacle revolting. You know you've sinned that person, the one rolling her eyes, biting her tongue, and refusing to join in with the compliment fest. Leaders need the awkward, principled people who will say no, or in this case, nothing, even when it's in their interest to say yes. As Cordelia said herself, "Unhappy that I am, I cannot heave my heart into my mouth. I love your majesty according to my bond, no more, no less." Naturally, as King Lear is a tragedy, he discovers the worth of his one good daughter too late. You don't have to end your career wandering heartbroken with weeds in your hair. Just don't listen to the sycophants
and seek out those that differ in opinion from yourself, and be genuinely open to having your mind changed. Number 3, know how to give a rousing speech. It's the morning of the Battle of Agincourt. You are the King of England, and you are about to lead your terrified troops into battle against the nefarious French. Weak words are not going to cut it. You are not going to catalyse actions. You are going to crush your foe. Shakespeare immortalised Henry V with his sabre-rattling band of brothers speech. The play captures an unimaginably distant time when leadership wasn't some woolly, abstract concept. It literally meant getting on your horse and riding out to battle, or riding shotgun on the van. To understand the work, you need to be in the work as much as your other responsibilities allow. Sometimes leadership can detract you from the actual work of the people that you lead. Make time for it. Spend time for the people. See them react to the work that you're asking them to do.
The Thin Blue Line with Bradshaw, Horton and Thomas.
Policing insights and opinions.
Well, that's it for this week. Thank you for joining us. This podcast is in partnership with Policing TV, the leading policing media channel. So until the next time and the next podcast, take care.